morning, we'll call case number 97-0896, Mottola v. Lerner. Hearing for the petitioner appellant, Ms. Mottola, is Aaron Halstead. Am I at all right? No? Pardon me?
That's correct.
Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Aaron Halstead, and I represent Connie Mottola in this action. Your Honors, this case involves the application of a state statute and a somewhat recent decision of this court to a set of facts which is essentially undisputed. The statute involved is the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of marital status. And the case involved is this court's decision in the case of Brotz versus Lerck, a 1992 case. The material undisputed facts are that Connie Mottola is an employee of the city of New Berlin, Wisconsin, and that the city has refused to provide her with a policy of health insurance in her own name, and that the reason for that refusal is her marital status. No one disputes that if Ms. Mottola were a single employee with a dependent child, that she would be entitled under the city's contract with the union to a family health insurance plan. In the Brotz case, this court said that there is neither an express nor an implied exception to the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act's prohibition against marital status discrimination. And the court also observed that there is only one, that the only express exception to marital status discrimination in the Fair Employment Act is that which allows a municipality to refuse to allow one person to supervise his or her spouse. Although this court also rejected in the Brotz decision any notion that there's an implied exception to the Fair Employment Act, the city and the commission have raised various arguments which they contend support the argument that the city of New Berlin is allowed to refuse Ms. Mottola a health insurance policy. The first basis for that argument is the Kozich case, and that was a case decided within the last 18 months by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. In that, Your Honors, I would submit to you that whether the holding in that case is correct is also in question here, in light of the fact that the statute which the Kozich court cited in support of this decision, which is 40-52(1)(a), requires the group insurance board to provide the standard insurance plan, which would be, quote, a family coverage option for persons desiring to provide coverage of all eligible dependents, unquote. There's nothing in 40-52(1)(a) which permits the group insurance board or the employee trust fund to refuse a policy of health insurance to someone in Ms. Mottola's position.
Counsel, under sub 4, though, the statute indicates the group insurance board shall establish terms of the health insurance plans for eligible employees who elect coverage. And it's under that provision that the board argues that it has discretion to do as it did.
That is correct, Justice Bradley, but in this case, Ms. Mottola has attempted to elect coverage, and there has been a complete refusal to allow her to have a health insurance policy. And I would submit that the language of sub 4, which you have cited, is not nearly specific enough to grant the group insurance board the discretion to refuse Ms. Mottola a policy in the face of the language of the Fair Employment Act, which prohibits marital status discrimination.
Now, initially, counsel, just to, so I get the facts clear in my mind, this was a bargain for provision in the New Berlin policy. In other words, initially, Ms. Mottola was single, married in 1980, and then chose to go under the married or group policy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then that was that provision was then, they call it the Mottola provision, but that was bargained for between the union and the employer and placed in the contract.
That's correct. Justice Wilcox, two points. First, it's my understanding that the basis for the commission's decision in this case is not that there's been a waiver, but secondly, at least under federal labor law, and I would suspect under state labor law, a bargaining representative is not permitted to waive a right of a person in a protected category and have that person bound by that type of a waiver. So I would submit that despite the fact that that language is in the agreement, it nonetheless could be found to be discriminatory, and that I would also submit that in no way has Ms. Mottola waived her right.
What effect would this have, I know affected on this case, but with other employers in where the husband and wife work for the same employer on non-duplication the policy? If we were to say and accept your argument that this clearly is discriminatory, would that have an effect on other employers?
Justice Wilcox, as I read the Commission's decision in this case, it purports to apply it to all employers statewide, not just the state, not just municipal employers, and not even just municipal employers who have opted to have the group insurance board provide them coverage under Chapter 40. It, in fact, would apply to private employers who have no right to opt into a group insurance policy provided by the board. And I know, Justice Wilcox, of at least three or four other cases which have either been decided by the commission or which are pending before the commission which present the same issue. And so clearly there's going to be an effect, and the effect I think is going to be difficult to know, because we don't know what types of policies are out there. In this particular instance, as the court is aware, the policy permits the termination of Ms. Mottola's dependent status if she should become legally separated from her husband, but the collective bargaining agreement wouldn't afford her a policy of insurance because she nonetheless would continue to have a spouse who is employed by the city. So there certainly is going to be some effect. I just think that if the court were to allow this exception to stand, we're never going to know until any particular instance arises what that effect might be.
Should this court be concerned with the impact to employers of your interpretation, at least of the commission decisions you interpreted? I remember in the Kosich case that the decision cites for state employees. My recollection is $20 million difference in premium for, I believe, 1 year, maybe it's 2 years. That's a big number. Is that discussion, the Kosich case, of any relevance to us? I don't mean that specific number, but that consideration of relevance to us in our consideration in this case.
I think, Justice Bradley, that certainly, in many instances, the legislature takes into consideration what economic impact a particular enactment is going to have. And I think that if the legislature has indicated to this court that the agency may take economic considerations in, may keep those in mind when it's making decisions or in the way that it exercises its discretion, then the court also then it would also be appropriate for the court to consider those things. But I think here, it's clear that the legislature has never said anything about what economic impacts this might potentially have on employers. And I think that is within the purview of the legislature to decide if financial considerations are paramount enough to make it decide to apply the same exemption to non-state employers if, in fact, the court decides that the Kosich case was decided correctly. And I would note that in the statute, which was formerly 66.919 sub 7 sub C, the legislature had given the Group Insurance Board and the Employees Trust Fund the right to decide what they were going to do in the event that there were more than one person in a family who were in, quote, state employment, unquote. And I think that had the legislature intended that to apply beyond the state, then it would have said so. And therefore, as I will argue, the commission's policy argument in this case is really based on nothing that the legislature has said. There's no legislative history that I'm aware of which shows that the legislature envisioned applying this rule to anyone but the state, if in fact it intended to apply it to the state.
You gave the example of a legal separation. I just want to call to your attention on page 14 of the red brief, Gurkowski, that they talked about legal separation, and they said that even if Ms. Mottola were to become legally separated, and that's your hypothetical because that's not the case here, that the city could not deny her health insurance coverage. And they indicate that that thought lacks a rational basis in law and should be disregarded by this court because that could not happen.
Your Honor, I think that, and I believe they refer to Chapter 767 in that argument, that chapter, while it does state what Your Honor has said, in this case, as I see the situation, Ms. Mottola would have to go to a circuit court or to the Commissioner of Insurance and have one of those two authorities declare that that provision is invalid as it is applied to her. In other words, the effect of the collective bargaining agreement, if she's legally separated, is to deny her a policy, is to deny her coverage. And so, essentially, what their argument is that, okay, maybe our policy is illegal, but there's another law that saves it if Ms. Mottola seeks relief from a circuit court or from the Commissioner of Insurance. And that by itself, I think, shows that she's placed in a situation or placed in a position which is different from someone who is single with dependents.
Mr. Halstead, we've heard a number of arguments having to do with potential. And as you know, one of the questions certified to us by the Court of Appeals relates to whether or not there's a need for actual harm. Can you tell us what, if any, actual harm has been suffered by or is going to be suffered by Ms. Mottola?
Justice Crooks, we have two. Justice Wilcox had observed that we had a discussion in our briefs about the impact of legal separation on Ms. Mottola. That's one of the instances. The other one is that
isn't that a potential situation, though?
That is potential.
She isn't legally separated from her husband, is she?
That is correct. She is not. However, prior to the time that she filed her complaint in this action, which was in May of 1994, the undisputed facts are that she would have opted. There were multiple plans offered by the City of New Berlin at that point from which employees could choose, and that Ms. Mottola made decisions about what doctor she would take because of the fact that she had to be a dependent under her husband's plan, and he had opted for a plan that was different. So she wasn't able to be within the same group of providers that she would have wanted to.
Is there something on the record as to what her plan and her husband's plan were before she went under his plan? I mean, were they different plans?
They each had single plans.
I understand, and then were they different providers, or were they different HMOs?
I'm not aware of what the facts are in that regard, Justice Geske. I know that
there's nothing in the record that tells us that.
Not that I'm aware. In 1984, when they became aware of the fact that they were going to have a child, is when they both applied for group coverage, and what happened was that her husband was given the group coverage, and that...
Did they apply for the same? I mean, is there something in the record that shows she would have opted for something else?
Only her testimony. There's nothing that in which says of the exhibits which we had in the record, which I think were 4 through 9, there's nothing which says which of those she would have opted for had she had the opportunity. But she did mention specifically in her testimony something about I believe it was eye care benefits or dental benefits also, in addition to the choice of doctors that she would...
Were any findings made as to whether she would have opted for other plans, another plan?
Without looking at the commission's decision, I can't remember. I have some memory that there was, but I don't remember. I do remember I think that there was in the early part of those findings, Justice Geske. Certainly, there was undisputed testimony in the record that that was the fact. I stated that under the Kozich case, there have been various arguments made, and even if, in this situation, the court were to decide that the Kozich case stand for the proposition that state employees are subjected to this non-duplication implied exception. And even if it went so far as to say, which I believe that the statutes don't support, that there are non-state employers who can opt into this non-duplication provision. The city of New Berlin, under 40.02 sub 25, has never acted to make such coverage available to its employees, and so there's nothing to show that the city is even part of this group of non-state employers who potentially enjoy the benefit of that so-called implied exception.
But counsel, I'm not satisfied with your answers to the previous two justices. The certification that we received from the Court of Appeals certified two issues, correct?
That's correct.
Second one is, when bringing an action under WFEA, must a complainant show actual harm? I think that's the point that they were getting to.
I would submit two things.
Did you address that?
First of all, I believe I stated that...
See, it troubles me, I'll tell you exactly where I'm coming from. It troubles me that that a person can bring a discrimination... It's a serious issue as to whether or not a person can bring a discrimination claim who has not been harmed.
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, I reread, after I saw the Court of Appeals certification, I reread the Bratz case. I didn't see anything in there which required the complainant to prove she'd suffered actual harm. Nonetheless, I think in this case, she has. I think that the loss, let's suppose that a complainant showed she'd lost $5 or $15 because of discrimination,
Well, you claim she has, but the problem that we have is we're not a fact-finding body. And at least as I read the record, there could be some serious questions of fact that have to be resolved with respect to whether or not she has been harmed. You argue that she hasn't been, or has been, but are there findings of fact to that effect?
In the finding of fact 14, I know the commission had found that that Ms. Mottola, should she become legally separated from her husband, that she would be treated differently from a procedural perspective than would a person who had a right to a policy of insurance in her own name. And
I'm not sure that's what it says. It says if their marital status changes. It doesn't talk about separation.
Okay. That's correct. And I guess I'm saying that's how I read. Those were the facts that I understood them to have relied upon in making that finding.
Why don't you look at 13? So long as their marital status continues, the rights of the spouse of an enrollee to health insurance benefits under the plan are no different from the rights of their spouse to health insurance under the plan. Now, if I heard you right, you say they are different. They both have to choose. I'm making this up. That's what I think I heard you say. They would both have to choose the same HMO. One couldn't choose a standard plan, and the other couldn't choose an HMO. If you were in Madison, then you couldn't choose. One couldn't choose UW plan, and the other choose Merida Hospital or Jackson Clinic or something. Is that what you're saying, Lewis?
I think the finding of fact that I was looking for, which is number 11, which says that that when the city at the point where she brought her discrimination claim, there were multiple plans offered, and the commission found that at such times application of the Mottola clause would have the effect of precluding two employees who are married to one another from having coverage for their own medical needs under different plans.
So you're saying that the harm is she doesn't have a choice.
I think that that's a...
And you're saying you don't have to prove that she wants that choice, but there is a harm because next week she may want that choice.
I'm saying that, and I'm also saying that in fact there was a direct impact here because her undisputed testimony was, and I can only presume that her testimony was the basis on which the commission made that finding, because it's the only fact in the record I'm aware of that would have supported that, which was her testimony that when they were forced to elect who was going to be the policyholder and who was going to be the dependent, she wanted to be treated by a different doctor, and so she made different decisions, and I think that that is as much actual harm as any monetary loss that a complainant could suffer under the Fair Employment Act. I think the choice is a very important issue when it comes to group health coverage.
But as far as their findings of fact, all you can rely on really is paragraph 11, right, which is prospective harm, possible harm.
Well, no. Justice Babich, what I'm saying is that there was in fact a point in time, not in the future, but that was the subject of her complaint and the subject of testimony at that hearing, where she said that in fact she had made a decision to elect different health care than she would have had she been permitted to have her own insurance policy.
Well, the problem I'm having with that is I think you answered that question the opposite way earlier in your presentation. I think somebody asked you, is there anything in the record that shows a difference in what kind of coverage she would get under single or dual, and you answered no. And now you're telling us, and I have not read the record, you're telling us that the record will show she did want a different choice than her husband.
If I spoke that way, I misspoke.
Okay.
I intend, and I think what I understood the question to be was whether or not there was actually some sort of a health care benefit in terms of something that wasn't paid that she wanted to have paid, or that she was denied a particular benefit in a given situation. And I'm not aware of anything in the record.
Let me ask you, and I may be misreading this, but the way I read 11 and 12 of the findings, 11 appears to talk about what happened historically, that there were options of different plans, and I'm reading this quickly, but it appears that number 12, at the present time, the city provides its employees only one health insurance plan through a group insurance policy. Did she have the option of choosing different plans at the time she was making the choice?
She had the option.
The city offered different HMO plans?
In fact, they did. And those plans...
Is that what this says? Am I missing?
What does it mean at the present time? The first one says since the mid-80s. And now it says at the present time. Is that as of July 31, 96?
At a point in time after she filed her complaint, the city reduced its health care plans to one. And so that was the situation after she filed her complaint. But as
I understand, everybody's under the same plan right now?
I don't know at this moment in time,
At the time of the hearing, everybody was under the same plan.
That's correct.
So at that point, she would have had to be under the same plan as her husband, even if there had been two family plans.
That is correct.
And but at the time she went under family coverage, there was an option of two plans?
That is correct.
Okay. So your point is you never know what they're going to do next year.
Well, next year
they may go back to several plans.
Correct, and I think it goes back to the same question that Justice Bradley had asked me, or Justice Wilcox, which is, what effect is this going to have if we make a decision against Ms. Mottola? And I submit that you can't know what effect that's going to have, because you're going to have private employers administering all sorts of different health care plans, and we don't know what is going to be or not going to be in those plans.
If you are to prevail and you go back, what kind of remedies are you going to get?
The remedy would be that the city of New Berlin would be ordered to provide Ms. Mottola with a health to make her a policyholder under her own health care plan, not to be a dependent under her husband's.
So to identify, assuming that the facts are the same as they are at the time of the hearing, they would be side-by-side identical plans.
That's correct.
And supplied through the same group health plan.
That's correct.
And what harm is there then? Since she doesn't have a choice to go under another plan.
The harm is that if in fact she is, if she and her husband, and I'm coming back to what we had discussed earlier, which is if she and her husband were to be legally separated, at that point she would be no longer permitted to be a dependent under his plan, and she wouldn't have the right to opt into her own plan. She then has to take steps under this particular plan. Under, there are two sections, under the conversion section or the termination section. She has to take steps to inform the city that she wants her own policy. The city then has to inform the plan administrator that she wants to have her own policy. And as the Court of Appeals noted in its certification, there was testimony here that that could subject, if the city failed to notify the plan administrator or notified them late, that she could be subjected to pre-existing condition limitations. And, Your Honors, I see my time has...
Counsel, I just, that's what I wanted to pick up. Under 632, it says that, and I'll just paraphrase it, no group policy which provides coverage to a spouse may contain a provision for termination of coverage for the spouse solely as a result of a breakup in their marital relationship. And that's what I was referring to.
And I think
except
that,
for the judgment of divorce or annulment, but it doesn't say separation.
And I think that this is the same sort of language that we've talked about in terms of Chapter 767. I don't have 632 in front of me. I know that that's referenced in Chapter 40, but I don't know if it's identical language to that contained in 767. Thank you.
McDuffie, I have you shown on my sheet for 15 minutes, and you're representing the city of New Berlin.
That's correct.
May it please the court. I am Elizabeth Ann McDuffie, and I represent the city of New Berlin, one of the respondents in this case. David Rice, my co-counsel, represents the Labor and Industry Review Commission, and Mr. Rice will speak to the issue of the determination of the Bratz decision by this court and the Kozitz decision by the Court of Appeals, and basically that if those decisions are read together incorrectly, that they establish that the city of New Berlin did not violate the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. I will address simply the issues that were raised by this court, that is that Ms. Mottola suffered no adverse impact by the non-duplication policy that the city maintains.
Counsel, that tell what bothers me, and it has to do with pre-existing condition. And in this day and age, pre-existing condition and health insurance coverage are huge considerations. I mean, I remember 15 years ago in divorce court, you wouldn't hear about health insurance, and now people sometimes don't get divorced. Their lives and their life planning is all centered around health insurance coverage. And so it's so this case is very important. This is what concerns me. There's a divorce. Then she has no policy. She has to get a new policy. And the insurer says, well, pre-existing condition. What if during the course of their marriage, when she was under this family insurance policy, she developed brain tumors or cancer? And so she gets divorced, goes now, and under COBRA, there's an 18-month or something continuation. But then, isn't she or other employees left high and dry? Because what insurance company, unless it's a big group carrier like the state takes, but what 15-person employer insurance company that employs that is going to take her on and insure her for her necessary cancer treatment or for treatment of that brain tumor when it's going to cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars? That's what concerns me.
Your Honor, in this particular case, Ms. Mottola is an employee of the city. The city has an obligation to provide her with health insurance coverage. Therefore, if Ms. Mottola were to, in effect, have a divorce occur, the city would have an obligation under its policy.
But the problem with this case is that we're not just, well, arguably, we're not just talking about state employees or city employees, depending on how you interpret Kozitz. We're talking about the 5-person employer, the 10-person, I'm talking employee, 10-person employee who goes to his local insurance agent and says, hey, Manson Insurance, I suppose I better give them some coverage. This is what I'm going to give them. And that situation, where they don't have this great big blanket of an employer, how do you protect that person?
Well, and this is going a little bit far afield, but there are protections in this insurance provisions with regard to that. Number one, as you indicated, If, in fact, the case that the city would not provide Ms. Mottola with health insurance coverage and it were another situation where pre-existing conditions was an issue. Number one, that employee would have the option to elect continuation coverage, either under
18 months.
18 months, that's correct. And there are also federal statutory provisions that have been enacted that go into effect January 1 of this year that basically exclude the pre-existing condition as long as that individual has had a previous 12 months or 18 months of coverage, so that an employer cannot apply a pre-existing condition provision to that particular employee if they've had prior coverage. So automatically that employee would come into the plan immediately.
But counsel,
and those are federal health insurance portability provisions.
But counsel, that wasn't the law before January 1.
No, it was not.
And how do we know that's going to be the law next January 1?
It may not be. That's right. The federal government obviously could come forth and decide to withdraw that particular statutory provision, and that protection under the federal law would not exist. But that would not abrogate the city's responsibility to Ms. Mottola to provide her with health insurance coverage as a city employee. The collective bargaining agreement is very clear on that issue. If you are a city employee, the city has an obligation to provide you with either single or family coverage, depending on your circumstances. And the city has not abrogated its position with regards to Mrs. Mottola. It has provided her with health insurance coverage. What it simply said is, as a cost savings measure, it will not provide her with duplicative coverage that provides no greater benefits.
Would she be eligible for recovery of payments for a pre-existing condition?
If, in fact, she lost coverage?
Well, under any circumstance. Any foreseeable circumstance.
Yes, if she had a pre-existing...
Because I take it you're arguing that she suffers no harm.
She suffers no harm.
And the concern of the court, obviously, is that if she can't get coverage for a pre-existing coverage, that may well be harm.
Well, the only way that the pre-existing condition issue that even comes into play is if, in fact, she loses coverage. And what I'm arguing is that there is no basis for her to lose coverage. She is either covered under her husband's policy under family health insurance coverage. If there were a divorce, then she would be covered under her own policy, because then the marital relationship would have been broken and the city would have an obligation under its collective bargaining agreement to provide her with coverage.
Is it automatic?
I'm sorry?
Is it automatic?
Yes, it is automatic.
What about on death?
On death of her husband, then obviously the marital relationship has been broken and the city again would have an obligation to provide her with health insurance coverage as a city employee.
Suppose he retires.
The same would occur. If he retires and is no longer an employee of the city, she is still an employee of the city, and the collective bargaining agreement states that a city employee is entitled to either single coverage or family coverage.
And how does that fit with the contract with the health provider that says when you get on to, if an employee is a new employee, it doesn't cover pre-existing conditions?
But she's not a new employee, I guess, and so that provision would not apply to her. She would have already exceeded the waiting period, and then she's already covered under the plan. So she's not a new employee. It changes the status of her coverage, assuming she were to elect single coverage.
Now, what about this concept of if there are multiple HMOs available, can the marital unit select different HMOs?
No, they cannot. They can only select to be covered under one or the other. That is, at the time that Ms. Mottola made the election, and it's unclear in the record whether it was Ms. Mottola who made the election or Mr. Mottola who elected for family coverage, the city maintained two different policies by two different insurance carriers, and they did have to select at that time one policy. But that selection by Ms. Mottola and her spouse is no different than the election made by a single employee if the city maintained two policies. That is, the single employee would also have to elect either...
I know, but if I wanted a standard, if I wanted HMO1 and my husband wanted HMO2, in a family plan, can we make that selection?
No, because those are two separate...
Right, but if I have my own policy as an employee and my husband has his own policy, two singles, then can I make my selection?
That's correct.
All right.
Yes.
And is it assured that there will never be two plans in the city?
Well, I can't say what the future will hold because that is speculative. Currently, there is only one plan maintained by Prime Care.
So if you should win, what happens to the Mottolas if in 2 years the city has two plans? Do they have to come back to court again?
No, I don't think so, because when we look at the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, what that is intended to provide is that the Mottolas get full health insurance coverage, and they do get full health insurance coverage with the city. The non-duplication policy that the city maintains is
So is it your position that this choice between HMO 1 and HMO 2 is really irrelevant and insignificant? They're getting coverage and... It's not discrimination that you don't let her choose her own plan.
That's correct.
That's your position.
Let me ask you about that, because assuming if the Mottolas, as they were previously, not married, they're both employees, they could have two separate plans.
That's correct.
But the moment that they enter into a marriage, one of them could lose the right to make that choice.
Not the moment that they enter into a marriage, because in this particular case, the moment that they entered into a marriage, they both maintain single coverage.
Okay. But they're both entitled to family coverage.
They're both entitled.
So you could have two single people who have family coverage.
If they had dependents.
Right. So if they had children, prior marriages,
but there's
or whatever.
But there's no relationship between those two single.
That's right. But those two people can choose, but the minute those two people get married, and our employees of the city, they can only choose one plan.
If they want family coverage, but they could still
But they had family coverage before, they still want family coverage.
Then they would have one family health insurance coverage plan once they got married.
So two people having children, not married, could be in two separate plans. The minute they enter into a marriage wanting still family coverage, one of them has, assuming they have different plans to start with, one of them has to give up the plan they chose.
That is correct.
Isn't that discrimination based on marital status?
No, I don't think so, because if a married couple is making an election with regard to coverage, they're making it, for instance, if two plans still existed, right now there's only one plan, if two plans still existed, then the single individuals make a decision about which coverage plan they're going to choose as well. That is, they decide to go with plan A or plan B. When those individuals get married, and they decide that they want family coverage, they make a decision, assuming the city maintains two plans.
These two people are treated differently if they both have family plans, whether they are single or whether they are married to each other. Because when they're single, they both can have family coverage, and they can have it in different HMOs, assuming that the city maintains two. The minute they enter into a marriage, one of them loses the option to choose. Unless they agree. I mean, assuming that they both want their plan, they can't have it.
That's correct.
So why doesn't that, it apparently differentiates between married people and single people? I mean, there's a difference. You have to concede there's a difference. It may not be discriminatory under the statute.
There is a differentiation, that's correct.
Okay.
But
so,
I don't, I'm sorry.
So why, now that's the next question, that's the setup, right? Mm-hmm. So now the question is, if you got a difference, why isn't the difference discrimination?
Because in the case of, under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, with regard to marital status discrimination and health insurance, employees make elections with regard to health insurance all the time. And if we take the logic in the answers to the questions that you're proposing to me, then what we would be basically doing is say, then when we provide single people with single coverage and we don't give them the option of family coverage, that we're discriminating against those single individuals as well, because we're not providing them with the same benefits that a married couple would get.
But don't you give single people family coverage?
If they have dependents. But that's an additional criteria. If they are single, they don't get the option. If they are single with no dependents, they don't get the option of family
coverage. But isn't their coverage the same if there's only one of them? I mean, as an individual, does it make any difference whether you have family coverage or individual coverage?
That is correct. And that's what we're arguing in this case.
But different HMOs can be substantial.
If different HMOs existed. But isn't that the same thing that happens with single individuals? That is, they get to choose HMO.
But each employee gets to choose, right? Under single individual.
That's correct.
And you're saying when you're married, each employee does not get to choose.
Well,
you only get one.
The employees, the married couple gets together and decide what the choice is for the plan. That is correct.
Do you have any idea what, obviously one of the interests I assume with the city is the duplication or non-duplication is a monetary cost situation. If that is part of the record, and I didn't see, that would be a considerable cost to holding that option open. Is that...
That's correct. Yes, and the difference in the cost is, at the time that this case was decided, $400 was paid for family health insurance coverage, and roughly $150 was paid for single insurance coverage. So if the city were to provide Ms. Mottola with a separate and distinct family health insurance plan under the Prime Care Health Plan, which they maintained when this case was decided, it would in effect spend $400 more to provide her with no additional benefits.
So that's the argument. Same services, but more cost.
Yeah, more cost. That's
Counsel, how, if we accept your position, how do we limit this decision only to employers that have large enough group health carriers that upon divorce, the employee can continue to get coverage even if it's pre-existing? How can we limit this legal proposition that you espouse only to those situations? If you were writing it, how would you do that?
In a case in which, and I think this case is a perfect example of how you.
But I'm concerned about the ones that I influence.
But I think the language in this case, if you were talking about a way of limiting the parameters of this particular, of your decision in this case, you would look to the language of the employer's policy. And if that policy provided that the individual would receive coverage notwithstanding the coverage that she has based on her marriage or based on his marriage, then the court would have the appropriate safeguards in place to make sure that if, in fact, one of those spouses were to leave.
But ten person in a law firm, I mean, you have a policy handbook, you have an employee handbook, you don't have any of these provisions for, you know, collective bargaining and all this sort of stuff. You go down, as I said, to the agency next door and you buy some policies.
Yes, but the benefit is provided by virtue of the fact that the individual is an employee of that law firm. And that is the standard that is applied in this case. It is not the plan.
Oh, so then the employer is going to, the attorney law firm is going to have to pay buckle bucks because I'm going to get a policy from Lloyd's of London that's going to cover her brain tumor.
If I buy insurance and you are an employee of my law firm, then you are covered by virtue of that status. You don't lose coverage unless you lose that status as an employee. And that is with the 10-person law firm as well as the City of New Berlin or any other employer. I see that my time is up.
Can I just ask a question? Can you tell me, would this case have turned out differently if Ms. Mottola had said, I'm going to stay with my single coverage and her husband had asked for family coverage?
Then there would only still have been issued one health insurance plan, one family health insurance plan. That is, Ms. Mottola could not have maintained single coverage and her husband maintained family.
You would have just denied that.
Yes, we would have provided one family health insurance.
Thank you, Ms. McDuffie. Mr. Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing Lurk.
May it please the Court, I'm David Rice, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Commission. I'd like to start off actually responding to Justice Geske's question. Isn't this a distinction based on marital status? And having sat here and having thought about this case, I think she's right. I think it is a marital status distinction. And I think that you're right, Justice Abramson. The question is whether or not the legislature intended this marital status distinction to be unlawful when it prohibited marital status discrimination in the Fair Employment Act. And the reason that we will see, the Commission believes, at least it's an open question, is your decision in Bratz, is whether or not there is an implicit exception. There's only one express exception to the marital status prohibition, which has to do with one spouse immediately supervising another spouse. There's nothing in that provision that deals with insurance. As an aside, before I go further, in Bratz, this court looked to 111.33.2d, which is a provision of the Fair Employment Act which allows an employer to vary insurance coverage by age. And in that, in Bratz, this court said that that applies to health insurance and that the legislature in that provision had decided that an employer could vary health insurance by age. If you look at that provision, it doesn't say anything about health insurance. It's arguably broad enough to include health insurance, but I would think that as a getting to be older worker, I would be concerned about interpretation of that provision that allowed health insurance to be determined by age, as opposed to, say, life insurance. And also in Bratz, the court went on to imply from that that because the legislature had considered, quote, health insurance, unquote, in the age discrimination prohibition, it must not have intended to include that in the marital status discrimination prohibition. I would suggest to you, having lived through the legislative history in 1982, that there wasn't any attention given whatsoever to health insurance when the marital status discrimination prohibition was added. It was thrown in just as an additional category from the housing statute, and I don't think much thought was given to it at all. And as a result, we do have some continuing issues. We have questions about whether nepotism, for instance, was intended to be precluded. We have questions on the health insurance, for instance. If an employer contributes $400 for a family health insurance plan and, say, $200 for a single health insurance plan, is that marital status discrimination in compensation? Because, at least on a disparate impact theory, married people then are getting a greater benefit from the employers. So there's lots of questions that the legislature didn't address. Turning to the second question certified by the Court of Appeals, must there be actual harm? They cite 111.321, which is the basis of discrimination section, and they're correct. That section doesn't address whether there has to be a particular kind of harm. That section just says it's unlawful to discriminate on certain bases and identifies them. But then it says it's unlawful to discriminate as provided in 111.322. So you look at 111.322, which says, as do most fair employment laws, it's unlawful to discriminate in hiring, firing, in terms and conditions of employment. So, yes, you have to have an action which falls within those definitions. So is this discrimination in terms and conditions of employment? I think arguably, probably fulfills the harm in that sense. And I think as a state employee, what this is really about is when you get married, if you've each had your own coverage, single coverage, and you get married and you have a child and you have to have a single family plan, that precludes me, if we get a family plan, from electing single coverage to stay with the doctor that I want. Or it precludes me from, say, we're Dean Care right now as a family. It precludes me from singly electing UCare so that I can have a surgeon of my choice to do a particular surgery.
So that's the harm.
Right. I think that's...
Harm is lack of choice.
I think that's primarily what it's...
That's primarily that you said.
Right.
Okay.
So we really get to the question of, should there be an implied exception here? And why do we think there might be?
Let me just say, if I understood you correctly, you think that there's a good argument, or that there's a marital status distinction here.
Yes.
And that there is harm if you have to make this choice of going into
the thing. Yes, and I think that's a condition of employment, so it satisfies the Court of Appeals.
So your position is contrary to Ms. McDuffie's?
I believe it is.
All right. And
I don't believe, if you look at the Commission's decision, they don't say it isn't marital status discrimination.
Pardon me?
The Commission did not decide that they decided that it wasn't unlawful marital status discrimination because there is an implied exemption.
That's what I'm getting at. So now we've got it set, so you have a marital status distinction. There is a harm. Now, how do you get it out from the statute?
Right.
And that's going to be your position.
Right.
All right.
Now, the question is, what did the legislature intend? That's the issue before you. And there are lots
of the implicit exception.
There's lots of, right. There are a lot of policy arguments one way or another. And if you think that the policy arguments, some of which have been suggested by Justice Bradley, are so compelling, maybe the legislature wouldn't have intended those. And that would be a basis for you. But ultimately, you're trying to divine legislative intent. What the Commission said, and I think it was correctly, in part because I argued Kosich. I think Kosich was correctly decided. Since 1960, by administrative rule, the state had exactly this policy that's at issue here, that if two people get married and they both work for the state, then you can have one family plan or two single plans, but you can't have two family plans. And when the legislature enacted provisions in Chapter 40 at the same year that they changed the Fair Employment Act to have marital status, they incorporated that longstanding administrative rule. And so I think the Kosich that correctly decided that although there's no express exception for state employees, the legislature could not have intended to prohibit in the Fair Employment Act that which they enacted in Chapter 40. Assuming that's correct, then in Bratz, we made the argument to you, if the legislature reached that result, if that should be an implied exception, then why shouldn't that apply to the school district in Bratz? And what the court said was, first of all, this isn't the state. This is a school district. And if you had stopped at that, I think there's a good chance we wouldn't be here today. Because then that's a reason, I mean, that's a line drawing. And you could say, well, the state had this special provision because we can't say they would have intended to nullify what they enacted for state employees. But that's just for state employees and not for anybody else.
What's the special provision? I'm just...
What provisions of Chapter 40?
Chapter 40 that you're talking about that address non-duplication and insurance.
Subsection 1, Subsection A, Group Insurance Board to establish a family coverage option for persons desiring...
That's my understanding. There's nothing in the statute itself that shows intent on this issue. What the statute shows is deference to the Group Insurance Board to do what it wants.
Right. Well, I think that what the court decided, and what I think is correct, is that they would have had such a long-standing policy prior to the enactment of those provisions, 20-some years, that it's unlikely the legislature would have intended to throw that out, and that this language, maybe inartfully drawn, was intended to incorporate that long-standing provision. Administrator Brewer.
Now, you said that Bratz dealt with state employees, and had they drawn the line there, that would have been enough, but right. What in Bratz brings you here today?
Okay, but then this court said that's not the only distinction between the state policy and the Mapledale School District in Bratz. The other difference is that in the Maple School District case, one spouse worked for the district. The provision was that if your spouse who worked outside the district had a plan, you could elect the school district's plan or the spouse's plan, but not both. And so that was how that was the facts of that case. So you distinguish the state policy by saying in the state situation, both people work for the state, and in the school district case, one person works for the state, for the school district, and one doesn't. So what the commission did is to look at that language of Bratz and said, how do we interpret that? One possibility is to say it's only the state that's different, and we ought to carve that out as an applied exception, but not touch anybody else. And that could conceivably be your holding today. But then the commission said, well, if that was what the court meant, why did the court add this additional language distinguishing the cases on the basis of two employees working for the same employer? And
what language are you referring to?
I'm looking at page 294 of Bratz, which is in 174 with second 286, where you said, even if we assume arguendo...
What page are you looking at?
I'm sorry, 294.
Good, thank you. All right.
Even if we assume arguendo that this policy indicates that there is an implied exception to the WFEA's prohibition against marital status discrimination, the school district of Maple policy would not fall within this exception. Here's the first difference. The state's policy is not the same as the Maple policy. The state's policy only applies where both spouses are employed by the state. Maple's policy applies no matter where the employee's spouse is employed. So the commission read that and thought, well, you must have meant something more than just the difference between the states. Maybe we're just making a casual observation, but they assigned greater significance to that language. And that's how they reached the decision in this case. In terms of policy, what they said was, when you decided the Department of Public Instruction case back in the early 70s and concluded that the state wasn't covered because it was not expressly covered, ironically, that the legislature really ought to cover the state because there's no reason why the state should be treated differently as an employer. In fact, the legislature came back in the same year and included the state. And so what the commission is saying here is that if Kosich is correctly decided, if there should be implied exception, then other employers, private and public, should be treated like the state in this limited respect. That is, where both employees work for the state, for the same employer, then the employer is free to limit family coverage to one policy for both spouses. In the case of the state, it makes a significant fiscal impact. If you look at Kosich, I think Justice Bradley was right. It's millions of dollars on the assumption that everyone would elect to have two policies. As to individual employers, it would depend on the employer. The impact on the employer would, of course, depend on how large the employer was and what portion of its expenditures were for insurance.
Counsel, I'm not sure. Are you saying that we should determine this based on municipal employment or state employment?
No, I don't think it depends on whether you're a municipal employee or a private sector employee. I think what we're saying is if there is a valid exemption, implied exemption for the state of Wisconsin, then by extension, that same provision should be granted to all other employers subject to the Act because of the desire for uniformity, which the legislature attempted to address when this court and DPI said that there ought to be that kind of uniformity.
And when you say subject to the Act, you mean WFEA?
Yes.
I guess I even raise that question again because in your conclusion, you emphasize that where both she and her spouse are employed by the same municipal employer.
Right.
Why did you say municipal employer?
Well, because the only case before us is municipal employment.
Okay.
I also said in a footnote that I suspect that there may be some question of ERISA coverage as to those large enough private employers who have plans and would argue that the state act can't regulate their policies anyway because of ERISA preemption. But there will be at least some group, maybe those smaller employers you were concerned about, that would come within the logic of this court's decision were it to affirm the commission.
Counsel?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Counsel, if we say that an employer can't do this, in other words, let's assume you lose, then aren't we going to be forcing all private employers and municipalities to essentially offer only one group health plan? Because obviously if they only offer one, then what's the difference?
That's true, although there still would be the duplication of costs, wouldn't there? Even with a single plan. And, I mean, I don't know why someone would elect it unless it was they had a sense of status that I need to have something.
Right, and then the result would be that they'd offer one, but then somebody could still take, the husband could take one, the wife could take the other, the same policy.
Right. It wouldn't make sense.
It would be a senseless duplication.
Right, and that's what we're trying to address here.
As I understand this, the way the law is now, and Bratz preceded Kosick.
I'm sorry?
Under Bratz, if the husband and wife work for different employers, then the employers can't limit their options, whether it's on marital basis.
That was your holding in Bratz.
The holding in Kosick is if they both work for the state, now they work for different entities in the state, but they both work for the state, then you come under that implicit exception for state employees and the state can limit a marital couple.
That's right.
And this case now is you're working for one employer, but it's not the state.
Right.
So the question is it closer to Bratz or Kosick?
Right. That's basically what the Court of Appeals certified to you. Which one of these should be followed, and why don't you decide it rather than us so we can get it resolved?
So, but I still haven't gotten from you why, and I gather you think Kosick is more relevant.
I think Kosick is correctly decided, and the question of whether it's more relevant is depends on whether or not you believe that under the Fair Employment Act, other employers ought to be treated the same as the state.
Well, what do you think the legislature believes, and what do you believe, Mr. Rice?
Well, I think that the legislature intended that other employers be treated the same as the state because that they responded to your decision in DPI so quickly within that same legislative session. You had this eloquent language about, even though the state's not expressly included, we're bound to follow rules of construction. We think, as a court, that we urge the legislature, I believe you said, to act quickly to include the state so that it's treated the same as other employers. I think, to be honest, I don't think that the legislature considered this. And that's the problem with determining legislative intent ever.
Well, maybe we should do what we did in Kosich. Maybe we should do what we did in Kosich. Say this is a big problem, but the legislature better address it.
Well, you had a chance in Kosich, but you denied review, so mm-hmm. I guess we don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Halston.
Two points that I would like to make initially. There are many situations in which the legislature has treated different employers differently. Treats the state differently than it treats other municipal employers within the spectrum of public employers. You need only look at the provisions of MIRA versus those of CELRA to note that. Only county and municipal employees are entitled to interest arbitration. State employees are not. In the public sector, the school districts are allowed to impose the qualified economic offer, whereas other non-state but public employers don't have that option. Certainly, public employers generally are treated differently in the state than are private employers. The point here being that there, as I can discern, is no statutory basis for the policy decision that the commission made in this case, which is that all employers have to be treated equally.
Let me see if I can find one. If you prevail, Ms. Mottola wins. As I understand it, she then would be able to get her own individual coverage, correct?
She would be able to, that's correct, have coverage in her name as a policyholder.
So her husband would have coverage in his name under a separate policy with a group health plan. She would have it with the same policy.
That's correct.
So what advantage is that to her? Obviously, it would cost the county more because now they're going to have to pay for two policies rather than one. You're going to have to pay for a family coverage and a single coverage. Or maybe she'd opt for a family coverage also. So the county's going to have to pay for two policies, which is a detriment to the county.
But it's the same situation that, let's say in the instance where...
What advantage is it to her?
The advantage...
There's only one group health plan offered.
At the present time, that's correct. That's different, Justice Babich, as you understand, from when she commenced this discrimination complaint.
I understand that.
But it also protects her into the future in two situations. One we talked over at length, which is the legal separation issue. The other is if, in the instance where the City of New Berlin and the collective bargaining representative decide that they're in the next contract, biennium, there's going to be more than one plan offered, and Ms. Mottola is still locked into a situation where she's a dependent on under whatever plan her husband decides to opt for. The Fair Employment Act, I attempted to see if I could find such a case, and I don't find any case in which this court has said that it is permissible for an employer to...